This is Arts Alive for this Saturday, February 18th. I'm Brian Lauritsen, and before we begin today's program, just wanted to say a quick word of thanks to everyone who made a contribution last week during our winter membership drive. It was so amazing to hear from so many of you. Thank you very much. On the program today, LA Opera Company, the industry has always been experimental, but they're really pushing the boundaries now.
We're really trying to sample the full range of what opera is right now. Let's try and make it as broad a range as possible, including stuff that we don't even know if it's opera. It may be so out there that we're not sure how it's supposed to be performed.
Yuval Sharon is the industry's artistic director. The company's getting ready for a concert of new works in progress, and Sharon tells us what's on tap in a bit. Plus, we're heading to Dreamland, the Museum of Latin American Art's Frank Romero retrospective. And on Ask the Dean, what makes an adagio? Dean Rob Cudietta of the USC Thornton School of Music and Gloria Kaufman School of Dance has the answer. First, here's Alan Chapman with the week's arts news.
From the Arts Desk today, new leadership at the Geffen, great news at Los Angeles Opera, and not so great news at San Diego Opera. Randall Arney has been artistic director of the Geffen Playhouse in Westwood for 17 years, but after his contract ends this August, Arney is stepping down, and the company has already begun their search for his successor. Arney directed many Geffen productions during his years at the theater. Executive Director Gil Cates Jr. said in a statement they are supremely grateful for Arney's inspired artistic leadership. During Los Angeles Opera's curtain call this past Sunday at the Dorothy Chandler Pavilion, the applause became even louder when two shiny objects appeared on stage, the two Grammy Awards the company had just won. The recording of LA Opera's 2015 production of John Corleone's The Ghost of Versailles won Grammys for Best Opera Recording and Best Engineered Classical Album. Congratulations to all. And San Diego Opera is not out of the woods yet. The company was reborn in 2014 after it nearly had to close its doors for good. Several big contributions allowed the company to stay afloat, but they reported this week that they lost nearly $300,000 during the 2015-2016 season. But they were able to make up the difference thanks to the previous season's surplus. The company's general director, David Bennett, told the San Diego Union-Tribune that things are trending in a positive direction. He said, "We are as vigilant as we can be about making sure the company is right-sized in expense and revenue and can be supported by the many people who continue to support the opera company here." That's the Arts News for Saturday, February 18th. On this date in 1735 in Charleston, South Carolina, a ballad opera titled Flora became the first opera of any kind to be produced in North America. The cast of characters includes Flora's lover, Mr. Friendly, and her nemesis, Sir Thomas Testy. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Question: how do you take your opera? Well done? Medium rare? Rare? Well, if you want the real tartare opera experience, look no further than next weekend's First Take, Second Take. For the third time since 2013, LA's avant-garde opera company, The Industry, is hosting a concert of new works that are still in development, and the composers would like your ears to help them find out what's working and what's the best way forward. Contributing reporter Tim Grieving sat down with The Industry's artistic director, Yuval Sharon, to learn more.
How has it changed since the first time you did it here? Have you adapted the approach or how you respond to submissions or anything like that?
The approach is almost exactly the same as the first time around because it was modeled on a program that I used to direct at New York City Opera, which was called Vox. And that was an extraordinary project for that company because they offered composers the full orchestra and professional soloists to try a work out in development. So a piece that was not yet commissioned to be performed anywhere, at this very earliest stage, they had a chance to sort of hear what the piece was like or which direction it was going. And there's really nothing like the experience of working with human musicians instead of the MIDI computer that otherwise composers hear their works on. So that opportunity to learn, that educational opportunity that this provided, I thought, was something I really wanted when I started the industry, because I wanted to stay connected to the development process of new works and also stay connected to other composers who maybe I can't actually produce their piece fully, but I can at least start that relationship with them and see a little bit about what's happening in the field, especially in the more countercultural or more avant-garde pieces that are out there.
So how does the submission process work? Is it just an open call and people from wherever just submit it, and you then have to sift through mounds of possibilities?
Yeah, basically. I mean, we had 70 submissions this year, and it was a team that reviewed them. Myself, Mark Lowenstein, the music director for the industry, Elizabeth Klein, the executive director for the industry, and Chris Rountree, the artistic director for Wild Up. We all took a look at all of the scores and kind of weighed in on what we thought would make the most well-rounded program. I don't think it helps any composer if you feel like you're seeing the same piece twice in a row. You know, we had a lot of pieces that fit in certain, I guess you can call them categories if we wanted to be crude about it. But I mean, each piece was very unique. But you know, thinking that for an audience, if we're really trying to sample the full range of what opera is right now, let's try and make it as broad a range as possible, including stuff that's really, that we don't even know if it's opera, you know, like that we it may be so out there that we're not sure how it's supposed to be performed.
How fleshed out are they in the submission process? Are they just an idea on paper, or have they begun writing it already? Are there demos? Mm-hmm.
Most of the time they're far enough along that they have a demo to go with it. For us, it's really important to just get a sense of what it's going to be like. There were two pieces this year, though, that were really just an idea, and it was based on the previous work of that composer, these two composers, that we said it's worth taking a risk, because that really is what this workshop is about, is taking as big of a risk as we can. In many ways, the consequences for this risk are very low. You know, I think everyone who comes to the workshop knows that it's a piece in development, and they might be messy, and they might be sprawling, and they might not quite cohere, even in the 20-minute version that you hear, but I think most people listen to the pieces and go, oh, there's something really interesting there. I wonder how that's going to evolve. That idea that these composers have this direct feedback mechanism with an audience is really, really key.
Why are you excited about these particular pieces?
I actually think we have an incredibly eclectic group this year. I think we have the last 2 years as well, but this one feels kind of different. This one feels almost more all over the place. We've got on one hand Nick Deo, who's a composer and a musician who I admire greatly, writing a darkly comic piece called Haydn's Head, which is about these gravediggers who discover Haydn's head and try and understand by going into it if they can find out the core essence of genius, if that's actually something that's phrenological.
I'll take your word for it.
I don't know. You know, it's like the phrenology of like where in the brain do certain feelings or actions take place. And I didn't know that Nick was such a Haydn lover, but it's kind of great to see him take Haydn and twist it with his own aesthetic. And I think that one is going to be really, really fantastic. Another one that I was excited about from the beginning was Laura Cartman's piece called Balls, which is a hilarious kind of triple entendre, as she likes to call it. It's about the Bobby Briggs and Billie Jean King tennis match from the 70s, and using that as a like an analogy for all battles of the sexes. And of course, we were going back and forth on this a lot during the election. So I know that everything that happened during the election has played a really key role in Laura's development of the piece. And it's just hilariously funny and energetic. And that's going to close out the evening. But all the pieces have some really unique and fascinating things about them. William Gardner and Thomas Rawl are creating a piece called All Is for the Best, which is going to involve real-time animation. And that was, in a way, the biggest risk that we took, because there was the least prepared for that. But we thought, you know, they're two really smart, creative creators. Let's give them that 20-minute chance to play and see what happens. And it's looking like a pretty, really cool piece. The idea of the animation is responding to the orchestra and to the singer in a way that sounds like it's also going to be a kind of dystopian piece. So a lot of dark pieces this year, but we also have a couple of really light pieces, like Mark Lowenstein, our music director, has written an opera for families called The Little Bear, and we're starting with that one so people can bring their kids early if they want to see it, which is this very sweet opera about fairy tales and the telling of stories. And Mark, in his way, incorporates a lot of Eastern musical ideas into it so that it kind of feels like it's even more fantastical and kaleidoscopic.
How involved are you in the staging of these? Are you just handing the keys to a stage and musicians and letting them kind of run as free as they want?
I mean, basically, I'll work with a very light hand to direct them, but all the singers are on, use the actual music with them. They're not memorized. I really don't want staging to distract the audience from assessing the work's merits. And I think that's often, you know, when you see a finished production, you sometimes can't quite tell, was it the staging? Was it the music? Was it the text? What wasn't working? And I think it's really, really valuable for the creators to not think about staging right now and just think about what's the musical and dramatic arc of the piece that they're creating. And from there, hopefully, we'll go someplace where there's staging.
Obviously, you are sort of vetting or just observing people coming through this as possible collaborators for the industry. Do you know if other opera companies are attending these workshops with kind of a scouting trip kind of mentality?
Yeah, I mean, that's one of the big goals for me once I started the project was to try and get as many producers from beyond to come check it out. We've had producers at each of the last two first takes, and we have some coming this year as well. And so far, it has been very fruitful for a couple composers each year as they find their proper home. I mean, we're such a small company, we can't really produce more than one large-scale project every 2 years, really. So we couldn't possibly produce all of these pieces as much as we are fascinated by them and love them and want to support them. But the idea that we give them the opportunity and make the connections to someone else who might be able to support them or realize their vision, I think is a really crucial part of that process.
First Take, featuring 20-minute excerpts of six new operas still in development, will take place next Friday night. Tickets are free, but seats can be reserved on the industry's website. On Saturday night, the company will kick off a new tradition called Second Take, performing the entire work of an opera they selected from 2015's First Take. The work is Bonnie and Clyde by Andrew McIntosh and Melinda Rice, which you're hearing right now. Tickets for that are $10 and are available at theindustryla.org. For Arts Alive, I'm Tim Grieving.
Listening to Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm your host, Brian Lauritsen. Still to come on today's program, a living legend in Long Beach. But first, we're taking you around town with Alan Chapman.
Here's a bit of what's happening around town, starting as we always do with a free event. And as a matter of fact, all the events we have for you today are free. Tonight, a celebration of Black History Month at Idlewild Arts. The concert will include William Grant Still's Afro-American Symphony and Gershwin's Rhapsody in Blue. Special guests are Marshall Hawkins and the Seahawk Modern Jazz Orchestra. That concert tonight at 7:30 p.m. at the Idlewild Arts Academy. For details, idlewildarts.org. And again, admission is free. Also free, a concert this afternoon at 4 o'clock at Pasadena's First United Methodist Church. They're going to be presenting organist Hans Hilscher. He's been organist at the Marktkirche in Wiesbaden, Germany since 1979. He's going to be playing music by 19th century European and British composers and some of his own arrangements and transcriptions. That performance, 4 p.m. today at First United Methodist Church in Pasadena. Information at fumcpasadena.org, and admission is free. Our third free event was inspired by the watershed year of 1517. Members of the USC Thornton School of Music's early music faculty perform music from before and after the German Reformation Tuesday night. Among the selections, improvisations on dances from Michael Pretorius's Terpsichore. The USC Thornton School of Music's early music faculty in concert Tuesday night at 8 p.m. at Newman Recital Hall on the USC campus. You can get more information on that and other performances at the Thornton School at music.usc.edu. And again, admission is free. And that's a bit of what's happening around town this week. For details on these and other cultural events in Southern California, visit performingartslive.com. For Arts Alive, I'm Alan Chapman.
This is Arts Alive on Classical KUSC. I'm Brian Lauritsen, and I hope you'll join us next week when we roll out the red carpet for the Academy Awards, Arts Alive style. That's next Saturday morning at 8. And you can listen to archived episodes of Arts Alive anytime with the Arts Alive podcast, which you can find at kusc.org. Coming up, we ask the dean, but first, big crowds are showing up for a big art exhibition in Long Beach. It's a comprehensive retrospective of one of Southern California's iconic artists, Frank Romero. We get details about the exhibition at the Museum of Latin American Art from contributing reporter Luis Torres.
The exhibition, titled Dreamland, a Frank Romero retrospective, just opened and will be up until the end of May. In its first week, enthusiastic crowds have made their way to the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach to experience Romero's wide-ranging work. It is a very comprehensive retrospective of Romero's art, a vast body of work created over some 50 years. There are more than 200 works in the exhibition, from easel paintings to massive murals to neon sculptures. Romero and his work are hard to pigeonhole, and he tells me he's fine with that. Portraits, cityscapes of Los Angeles, wildly whimsical paintings of vintage cars, it's a vast and varied collection of works. Most of the early work evokes the energy, political turbulence, and promise that characterized the Chicano movement for social justice in the 1970s and into the 80s. I spoke with Frank Romero at his studio in Lincoln Heights, and then again at the Museum of Latin American Art when the show opened.
To me, it's a celebration of our culture, of life. So far, just the people I've talked to at the museum and everyone has a smile on their face. It's a joyful event, and I'm really proud of that.
Frank Romero first gained recognition and critical praise in 1974 when he teamed up with three other Chicano artists, Carlos Almaraz, Gilbert Luján, and Roberto de la Rocha. They formed a group called Los Four. He reflected on those early beginnings and on his lifelong work as an artist.
Everyone calls me a legend or the iconic artist, but I think those are all euphemisms to the fact that I'm really old.
You're prolific, but it's also a matter of fact that you've been around a long time.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. And our first exhibition as a group with Los Four was in 1973 at UC Irvine, and that was picked up by LACMA the year later in 74. And I believe in that exhibition, we actually broke attendance records. I think we still hold the record. We had, you know, lines around the block. It was an incredible event and very much part of the Chicano movement at the time in the 70s.
That exhibition, Los Four at LACMA, that's a landmark.
Exactly.
The Los Four exhibition at the Los Angeles County Museum of Art in 1974 was a pivotal event in bringing Chicano art to the general public.
It was very Chicano in that respect. And the truth is we kept bringing all this art into the museum, and they realized that we couldn't take these two little rooms they gave us. So they gave us the entire second floor of the wing we were in. Mm. And the show just took off, and we broke all the attendance records at LACMA, not some major 18th century artist. No, we broke all the attendance records, and we had a line around the block for the opening night. It was amazing.
Not that Chicano art needed legitimizing, but
it did
serve that
it
purpose.
Served that purpose. Mm-hmm. I mean, a major art museum saying that this phenomena is so big now.
Frank Romero tells me soon after that groundbreaking exhibition, they added a fifth member to Los Four, Judith Hernandez.
Carlos Almaraz came up with the idea that, we were being somewhat chauvinistic and that there were only four men in this exhibition. Mm-hmm. And we invited her to show, I believe in our sex exhibition, when I believe it was Long Beach. Mm-hmm. And she showed with us ever since.
Los Angeles artist Frank Romero, whose work is featured in a vast retrospective at the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach, tells me he knew as a child that painting would consume him and be his life's work.
I think I always painted, and I know no other life. But let's say we were almost 40 when Los Four happened, the late 30s. And I'm now 75, and I've been painting for the last, 45 years. And it's just what I do. And of course, like in high school, I had a teacher that studied at the University of Chicago. I mean, the Art Institute of Chicago.
Oh, sure. Where the Hopper is.
Yeah, all of that stuff. Hopper, of course, was a great influence on me because, I realized this recently, he painted Victorian houses. And where did I live? In Boyle Heights, which was all Victorian houses. Mm-hmm. That's very interesting. Mm-hmm. There was a relationship there that influenced me. Being part of Los Four, Carlos and Gilbert and I studied the that's part of Los Tres Grandes.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
So we were the four. And we did a lot of murals.
Yeah, yeah.
And that was just part of the Chicano art movement of the time in the 70s.
In the exhibition, there are slyly cheerful paintings of old cars and whizzing motion on LA's freeways. There are portraits and landscapes rich in color and emotion. And there are the more overtly political pieces, such as the paintings about the death of journalist Ruben Salazar at the hands of the police, and stark dramatic paintings depicting what can only be described as police brutality in East LA. And there are whimsical paintings that can put a smile on your face, all part of the exhibition now on at the Museum of Latin American Art in Long Beach. The curator is Edward Hayes.
So in the Pantheon and in the whole scheme of things, Frank is a contemporary artist, but he's had a number of moments, and I think it's a constellation. I think Frank's career is this like constellation, and I think with Dreamland, we kind of picked that title for the show because in some way it kind of encompasses Frank's world. And so this is Frank's world we're going to present. Dreamland, we're going to touch upon different moments in Frank's career. We're going to do some time travel to the Los Four period and from the 70s. We're going to look at his politically charged body of work from the 90s. Mm-hmm. And we're also going to take a look at his rendezvous in Paris, and we're going to take a look at that body of work, which is Frank Impressionist. Throughout it all, you'll see what ties Frank's work together, and it's this activity, it's the brushwork, it's this effortlessness mm-hmm. in the work, mm-hmm. and it's this kind of going up to bat every day, and the hand is what ties it all together, this brushwork,
This exhibition, I'm guessing, when you're through selecting all the right pieces, it's going to cover a huge expanse of time, and thematically as well. What are art lovers, visitors to the museum, what are they in for?
You're in for a Frank Romero spiked fruit punch. We're going to pack a lot of punch in the show.
For more information about the Frank Romero exhibition at MOLA, go to MOLAA.org. For Arts Alive, I'm Luis Torres.
Now, here once again is Gail Eichenthal with the question about taking it slow for Dean Rob Kudieta of the USC Thornton School of Music.
Dean Rob, great to see you.
It's great to see you, Gail.
Our question today comes from Dr. Daniel, who wants to know, it's very poetic, what makes an adagio?
It's a beautiful question. Sounds like a setup for a joke, actually. You know, we've talked over the years on doing this show that so often the simplest of questions really isn't, and that the simplest of question has a long, complicated answer. So here's a simple question, but it doesn't fall in that category. It really has a very simple answer. The adagio, it's a term that's used for a piece of music that's slow. And if you think back to some of the things we've talked about naming and names used for symphonies and movements and how they really structure larger pieces, to hold a large piece together, they'd build them off dance forms. So there was a dance suite. Then we got into symphonies and there would be movements. And this was really a way first to talk about the relationships between the movements. So you'd have a fast movement. You'd have a slow movement, you'd have a fast movement. That was a very basic design. That's what we'd call it. Well, we wouldn't use the word slow because they weren't speaking English when they were doing that. They'd use the Italian word. So that really is what it amounted to. There's no specific form or something that is an adagio. That word is used beyond the symphony, though. For example, adagio for strings, everyone's favorite, is really an adagio. It's a slow piece for strings is the way you can interpret that. So there's nothing hidden here. It really is a functional word, but it also describes that here is the slow movement or here's the slow part, and usually implies very expressive, but that's really nothing beyond that. So there's nothing that makes an adagio, except that it's played adagio.
Is there a metronome marking limit to adagio?
Oh,
where
there probably
it becomes
is.
A tiny bit more allegro.
Oh, sure. because all of those tempo markings are certainly open to interpretation, and you'll hear people taking an adagio too fast or an adagio too slow because it certainly is a matter of interpretation, and there is a very, very large range. But I've never seen anybody take it so fast that they've had it change the title in the program with an asterisk, or he thought it was an adagio, but I don't agree. Nothing like that.
Okay. Thank you so much, Dean Rob.
Thank you.
Do you have a question about music for Dean Rob Kudieta and his team of experts? Or what about a question about the world of dance? Music or dance? Email your questions to askthedean@kusc.org. Again, that's askthedean@kusc.org. And that wraps up this edition of Arts Alive for this Saturday, the 18th of February. I hope you'll join us next week when we dabble in a little movie magic for our annual Oscars edition of the program. That's next Saturday morning at 8 on Arts Alive. The technical director is Mark Hatwan. Kelsey McConnell is the executive producer. We had help this week from contributing reporters Tim Grieving and Luis Torres, and from KUSC's Alan Chapman and Gail Eichenthal. Thanks also to Sheila Tepper. I'm Brian Lauritsen. Have a great week.